Yes, I am. I know. I know, because yesterday I went over and I was like, hello, everybody, and welcome to NeoCon Talks. This is our second out of four conversations today that we're doing in partnership with the Mart. My name is Katie Sargent. I work at Work Design Magazine. This is a new series that the Mart has going on this year, so thank you for being here. We have 20-minute conversations going on for yesterday as well as for today. If you missed any of them, we'll have a recap with audio recordings of the entire conversations on workdesign.com. I want to thank our sponsors for making this possible, Formica, Flexform, and Dauphin. We also have some fun giveaways going on that you have been automatically entered to receive by entering this space wearing a NeoCon badge. We're giving away some chairs as well as the vignette set up over here. The four orange chairs and the four tables will go away to four lucky winners. So check your email after NeoCon to see if you're the winner for that. And now I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Dr. Sally Augustine.
Thank you. I think we're somewhat acoustically challenged today. So are you guys here to listen to the talk? Raise your hand if you're. Okay. All right. I'm going to try to be. Sometime I'll stand in the middle here and sometime I'll stand over there. Try to be fair about it. So today we're going to talk about sensory experiences. We only have 20 minutes, so we're going to move right through our topic. I wanted to take just a second to explain who I am. I'm what's known as an applied environmental psychologist. That doesn't mean I actually know anything about recycling or sustainable design necessarily or anything like that. Applied environmental psychologists think about how what's in the world around you influences what happens in your head. So that's the context in which I'll be talking to you today. And also the information I'll be sharing with you has been rigorously derived through scientific research, so you can apply it with confidence. And I'm hand challenged today since I have a mic and paper. So when we're talking about sensory experiences, the first thing to acknowledge is we each have a dominant sense. And this is the sense that we have that's most sensitive. It's the most direct route to our emotional experience, and it's how each of us would prefer to learn about and interact with the world around us. Almost all of us are visually dominant, but regularly I find somebody who's more olfactory dominant. I'm one of those people. And rarest of all, I find somebody whose dominant sense is a sense of touch. To determine what someone's dominant sense is, an easy way is to get them talking about important events in their life and see what sorts of sensory experiences they start to bring up. There is a lot of attention to visual experiences in our world because not only are most of us visually dominant, but also we tend to communicate about design via pictures, which just reinforces the attention to vision. But most of us happily have other senses. And when we're thinking about the sensory melange that we want in a workplace environment, it's generally one that's a little more calming, a little more relaxing, because humans get revved up being around other humans. We just can't help it. That's the kind of animal that we are. And if we're in a really energizing environment, we are around other people, our minds get pushed to the energy level where we can't perform to our full potential. So regularly today, I'll be talking about experiences that are relaxing, for example. Now, when we're thinking about this sensory experience mix, we need to make sure that the sensory experiences that you're designing into a space are all coordinated. They're consistent. They're not haphazard. When one sense is getting cues to think in one sort of way, another sense is getting another sort of cue, you end up stressed. People's evaluation of experiences degrades. I care about stress because when people are stressed, their performance on whatever you're paying them to do is degraded. So when I'm talking about consistency, and when you're thinking about consistency, you need to think about three different factors. You need to think about whether experiences, sensory experiences, are relaxing or energizing, positive or negative, and also logically consistent. And since our time is short today, I'll go with a really quick example of sensory experiences being logically consistent. In our society, we link cinnamon-type smells with end-of-year carols. You know, if you put cinnamon smells up in spring when you're playing other sorts of music, there's a disconnect. You can develop sets of experiences that are surprising or challenging, but it's hard to do that without creating a negative experience overall. If you're ever interested in doing that, be in touch. So again, our individual sensory experiences need to be consistent, and they also add together in our head to produce an overall response that has emotional, cognitive, and physical aspects. Just like you put ingredients in a stew pot and get a stew, those individual components are still recognizable later, but you have this mix. So you have everything adding up in your head to produce one overall experience, you know. So therefore, like when we're thinking about workplaces and we're trying to create a space that's generally calming because it's going to be used by multiple people, you're trying to do things like include colors that are not very saturated but relatively light because they're relaxing. You're trying to use patterns on upholstery or whatever that have more curving lines than straight lines and sharp corners. You're thinking about soundscapes that are things like nature sounds. And if you can add scents, smells, the scents you're using are like lemon and lavender. All that is consistent, adds together to create a place where people perform to their full potential. And today we're not going to talk about taste, but there's some fascinating research, if you're interested, about things like how the color of plates influences like what people think things taste like and stuff like that. So there's all sorts of avenues in which we can think about these sensory combinations. Okay, so when you're thinking about using sensory experiences, you have to realize that different senses are good at conveying certain sorts of information and are good in different circumstances. For example, senses that you can perceive from a distance, like usually vision or sound, they'll have a more significant effect on experiences than things you have to reach up and touch to know if they're smooth or itchy or whatever. And in general, when you think about purposes to which you're going to be putting different sensory experiences, vision is very handy, and it's what we generally use to determine if something's functional, if it's going to work for us. But sense, smells, are really important in determining our emotional response. You know, we can scent anything out there. There's the technology to do that. And tactile experiences, when we actually touch something, that has a really powerful psychological effect on us. When we touch it, we feel like we own it. And that influences our psychological response, whether we feel comfortable, etc., having someone else near it, things like that. So we always are needing to think about how different senses can serve us in particular situations. And it's also true that important senses change over time. For example, when you originally buy something like a chair, you know, as I say, if you're thinking about functionality, then visual would be dominant. You'd be really into what it looks like. But over time, as you sit in that chair, tactile experiences will become most important for you. So the importance of various senses will change over time. It's also important to remember that every sensory experience influences every other sensory experience, which makes life pretty complicated. But there are things like when we see warm colors, we actually feel physically warmer. The difference between experiencing cool colors and warm colors in perception is about 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which can make a real difference depending on where you are, what sort of experience the people would be having. So it's important to think about colors and temperature, for example. I guess since I miss lunch, taste is really top of mind for me, but let me give you another example of how things are related. We associate curved things with sweet tastes and more angular things with bitter tastes. So people in Europe have done experiments with chocolate bars. They take exactly the same chocolate. They pour it into a mold with rounded corners. They pour it into a more rectilinear mold. People will swear that that chocolate bar with the rounded corners is sweeter and the one with the sharper corners is more bitter. You know, there are really hundreds and thousands of examples of how things come together like this. And obviously, you know, 20 minutes, all that, we're not going to get through them. But I do have a couple other examples I can share. For example, things that are red, like cars and trains, seem louder than things that are other colors, for example. When we think, when we're too hot, we think, when we perceive we're too hot, we think the quality of the air where we are is bad. So in other words, the air smells musty to us. And just as a general point, that I think is useful. If you're creating something or doing something where you want people to think of functionality, efficiency, etc., work in lots of straight lines, right angles, that kind of thing. If you want people to feel comfortable, pleasant, etc., like in a break area, use more curving lines in 2 dimensions, like upholstery, or 3 dimensions in the shape of furniture. We also have to recognize that there's a halo effect with sensory experiences. If one experience you're having is positive and another experience is not so clearly positive or negative, that ambiguous experience will get evaluated in line with the definitely positive or definitely negative experience. So that was really a long, convoluted sentence. But to give you an idea what I'm talking about, if you're in a space and you like the way it sounds for whatever reason, like there's a burbling brook or whatever. Anyway, if you think you're in a place that sounds good, you'll evaluate it as smelling good also. That's what I mean by a halo effect. And, of course, it's vice versa. And when you're asking people about their satisfaction with an environment in general, they'll talk to you in terms of the thing in the environment that they're least satisfied with. So if people are in a workspace and they would actually evaluate everything pretty positively, except for, say, the air, which they view as stale, so it gets a negative evaluation, well, the whole space will be evaluated negatively because it will be evaluated in line with that most negative experience. Now, in another time when we're talking about sensory experiences, in particular when we're talking about using multiple sensory experiences together, is when we're doing biophilic design. Biophilic design is important because it makes us feel comfortable, it lowers our stress levels, our brains work better, well-being improves, all sorts of good things happen when we're in a biophilically designed space. But when we're thinking about biophilic design, we have to think about sensory richness, all our sensory experiences in general, and we also have to remember that they need to be dynamic, because when you're designing biophilically, it's really like you're building a meadow on a lovely spring day. So you'd be talking about things in a biophilic space, like in terms of visuals, like having natural light, natural colors, not too much going on visually, sort of as much visual complexity, say, as an interior design by Frank Lloyd Wright. You would have prospect and refuge. People would be in a secure place with a view out over the world around them, whatever. So those are some visual experiences you would have there. Acoustics, nature soundscapes, burbling brooks, gently rustling leaves and grasses, quietly singing birds. All this is part of biophilic design. So we're talking about visuals, acoustics, sense, nature sense generally. Indoor plants, which we see and smell, for example. Natural surface materials, such as wood with visible grain. This is, again, a sort of combined see-touch experience. And research consistently shows that biophilic design is much more powerful when all of these sensory experiences, but people are getting through all these sensory channels, is coordinated. When it is, you really see cognitive performance and well-being get a really big boost. Now, when we're thinking about space design, we do have to remember that more than one person is almost always using the spaces that we're working on. They have different dominant senses. They might be neurodiverse, you know, for example, with people with ADHD, they really do perform better when they're in a more pared back environment without quite as much going on visually or acoustically. So, you know, you have to think about different kinds of users. People with different sorts of professional training respond differently to a space, the sensory experiences they have in the space, and that's because, like, people with design training, for example, are taught to literally look or feel along for different sorts of things in a space. Personality matters in terms of sensory experience. Those of us who are extroverted, we can't get enough bright colors, strong smells, things like that, where somebody who is more introverted does do better, have a more pleasant life when experiences are more carefully curated. And even gender makes a difference. For those of you who have had arguments at home, women actually do have a better sense of smell than men. They also have better color vision than men. They'll be more, it's easier for them to tell if, like, two samples are actually the same color or different colors. So it goes on. But, you know, we're talking about individual differences and how they affect sensory experiences and things you need to keep in mind. Now, we also have to remember that sensory experiences can be used for very particular purposes and combinations, like we can use them to give people a comfortable feeling of control and privacy, which will improve their professional performance. They can be used to make a space more comfortable for people culturally. They can be, you know, color and scents, particularly scents that are known as green. That means scents that smell like natural things. Well, particular light colors and green scents will make a space seem more spacious. Again, you know, if we're thinking of, you know, particular mindsets you want to encourage, you can use sensory experiences to generate awe awe. First of all, awe is really hard to say if you're from Boston, like I am. So it's A-W-E I'm talking about. Because in Boston, we only have one vowel sound. So anyway. Multiple sensory experiences can combine to produce awe. You know, you can be awed by size, workmanship, etc., combinations of materials, and you care about awe because when people are awed, they behave better to others and their minds work better. Even safety can be enhanced when you start to think in a multisensory perspective. Like, you know, how many people have you seen trundling happily towards the top of a staircase while they're typing something in on their phone, you know, and happily in most circumstances or in many circumstances, people put a different texture down before the moment of truth at the top of the stairs so people don't tumble down the stairs, but, you know, that tactile experience underfoot can help. We are getting towards the end. First, I want to make the point that the language that you're speaking has a tremendous influence on your sensory experiences. And the native language, that's the first language that you speak, continues to influence your experience of senses throughout your entire existence. Let's give you some examples. If the first language you spoke has gendered nouns. Now, what is a gendered noun? Pretty much everybody has a foreign language requirement to graduate from school. So probably you've all taken like either French or Spanish, you know, and you know like French like uses la as the in front of some nouns. Those are feminine nouns. And le in front of other nouns it makes them masculine. Anyway, if your first language had gendered nouns, even if later in life, when you're speaking English, that original language will continue to influence your expectations and experience of design. Because, like it or not, when we first experience something with a gendered noun later in life, we expect and desire that it will have more stereotypical feminine features, if you will, and the same goes for masculine nouns. So what does this mean? A lot of the original research was done for God knows why, but for some reason in Europe with bridges, because the word bridge is masculine in some languages, feminine in other languages. Well, people who first speak a language where bridges are feminine want bridges to have curving, swooping lines, to be delicate, to be elegant, etc. People who, and this is way past when they leave the place where they learn to speak this original language, and if they're speaking English, where there really aren't very many gendered nouns. People, to continue with the bridge example, people who grow up thinking of bridges as masculine want bridges over rivers, etc., to be powerful, strong, rectilinear, that kind of thing. Also, foreign languages can differ in how they describe colors, and the color words in the first language you spoke will affect what draws your eye color-wise throughout your entire life. For example, in Russian, there are two completely separate words for light blue and dark blue, not just like an adjective added in front like in English. And since Russians have to clearly pick one word or another, or they learn to do that, later in life, no matter what language they're speaking, they're really good at differentiating between light blues and dark blues. You know, things, differences that those of us who just add adjectives, we don't pick up on it. And I do want to make the point before we go on that people's sensory experiences are more vivid and vibrant if you talk to them about their sensory experiences in that first language. So like if you're doing research and trying to learn what people feel it's like to work in a space, even if your workforce is technically bilingual and actually speaks multiple languages really well, speak to them in their in their primary language. Now our last topic, which I'm sure will relieve Katie to know I'm on the last topic. But first of all, when you're talking about sensory experiences, you gotta remember that perception beats out reality. It's always going to prevail. For example, people's perceptions of the ambient conditions in a workplace stress them out much more than the actual objective experiences. If for some reason people have been led to believe, for example, it's too hot or too cold where they work, those perceptions of too hot or too cold will generate much more stress than whatever the thermometer actually says. The research shows over and over again that objective measurements alone don't reflect people's experience in a space. And to give you some examples of how distorted our experiences can be, an ambiguous sound was played to some people in one circumstance. And some of the people were told it was, you know, a nature sound. Other people were told it was an industrial sound. It was exact same sound. The people who had been told it was a nature sound were refreshed after hearing the sound, and their cognitive performance improved. People who heard it was an industrial sound, that's not the same effect. Another example, some researchers in the UK have learned that our responses to sound conditions are only 25% of the difference in our experience of one place or another is actually due to the true noise level. We get preoccupied with things such as we're less annoyed by another sound if we think people can't control it. Like, you know, we're more annoyed when we think they can control it and are not, etc. So, again, you think some of these things are so hardcore and objective, and they're not. I want to, in closing, talk about some of the scariest ways that perception. I used to say perception trumps reality, and that was so easy and nice. But now, and I, like every other sentence, it doesn't have any political association. It's so much more convoluted. But anyway, placebos work in space, and you can have positive placebos, and you also have negative placebos. You know, again, perceptions drive reality. Also, when people are in a better mood for whatever reason, like it's nicer weather outside, their evaluation of the conditions they experience are more positive. When people are unhappy about their jobs for whatever reason, they are quicker to criticize the ambient environment in which they find themselves, quicker to complain about the noise levels, the temperature, the freshness of the air, etc. And people, for example, in one study, who felt their work was never interesting, who felt they had a greater workload, thought they couldn't control their environment, they had many more complaints about their physical environment than others. Also, people who feel that they're professionally successful will evaluate their work environments more positively. And people who feel that a space is more representative of who they are as a person will evaluate it more positively than those who don't. So, Katie would be pleased to see this slide show up again because it's clear we're near the end now. But, you know, we've had a chance to talk about some of the neuroscience of sensory experiences, especially when they're combined, and how they can have a dramatic effect on how people feel in a space, their levels of well-being, how they perform, etc. As I mentioned, I'm very extroverted. I love to talk about this stuff. I knew we wouldn't have time for questions in our 20 minutes, but feel free to email me just, you know, to chat about this kind of thing. I really enjoy talking about neuroscience and how it affects people's experience in a space. So I assume I'm out of time because even when I have more than 20 minutes, I always run out of time. So it was nice to be with you today, and be in touch.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you to Dr. Sally Augustin. Always learn so much from you. Really appreciate you being here. We're going to move on to our next talk, and I'm going to introduce Jill, and we'll get right into it. Thank you, everyone, for being here.